I fully thought we were going to go grand scale Cosmere. There were a few people that dropped hints or warnings or whatever. They were like, oh yeah, Isles of the Emberdark, it incorporates a lot of things. It was kind of something a couple of people said to me going into it. And I think I misunderstood that. Because they're right. There's a lot of elements baked into here. And you can pick up on a lot of things. But it's not grand in scale. It's very small in scale, actually. It's really just in the heads of two characters going on one single adventure in one single place. Welcome back to Following Noadon, a Stormlight podcast. This is episode 290. I'm Elliot, here with Paul and Trevor, as always. And this episode I've been looking forward to for quite a while, ever since I put down Isles of Emberdark after reading the entire thing in five-ish days. I set this thing down and I thought to myself, this one is going to be super fun to talk with Paul and Trevor about in its entirety. What does this mean for the Cosmere? What were your feelings on this book as a kind of a side quest here in the larger picture of the Cosmere? So we get to do that today as we do our wrap up for the book, look back over it, do our rating, share some of our kind of final thoughts as we bring to a close Isles of the Emberdark and bring ourselves back to Cosmere current. Trevor, how are you today?
I'm doing well. It does feel nice to be Cosmere current. Again, there's so many asterisks in the Cosmere
of being
Cosmere current. And there's preview chapters for Fires of December. We haven't read White Sand, but in spirit, we're Cosmere current. And yes, it feels nice. I definitely enjoyed Isles of Emberdark. It was a nice... The phrase I was going to use is palate cleanser, but that's such a negative vibe on Wind and Truth, so I'm not going to say that. It was a very nice refresher on what's going on in the Cosmere besides Roshar.
Paul, how are you?
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Wrapping this whole thing up. It's surreal to think, of course I could go on and on about how many episodes we've had and all this stuff. This isn't the episode for that exactly, but feels good to feel like I've crossed the finish line. As Trevor mentioned, we kind of haven't, but we have, and I'm excited to be through it. I think Isles of the Emberdark was a wonderful book. I'm excited to talk about it further. So yeah, all in all, I'm doing really well.
Paul, every time we do these episodes, you always say that these are your favorite format episodes, so you have to say that.
Oh, I'm really glad that we are doing this, because this is my favorite format episode. I love looking back, ragging on the book, saying all the things I like and don't like. This is really my time to just give opinions and not like, what is happening here? What predictions do we have, Here's where it's just flat out what I think, my opinion, and it's kind of fun. So yeah, once again, it's my favorite.
These episodes always make me feel like I'm in a book club. This is like the book club style. We get back and talk about the book we've read. But before we get into kind of our big takeaways, general thoughts, favorite moments, we're going to run through our normal rating system that we've got. Give it a score, 5 different categories, 10 points each, final score out of 50. Trevor, I don't actually remember the format of how we usually do this. Where do we start?
We've done two different things. We've all given the same category at the same time, or we've all gone through our own fully. We've done both. So whatever you would like, podcast host.
I guess that is me now. Let's do this one person at a time. This was a book that I thought was enjoyable, kind of within its own, fully encapsulated in its own thoughts. So I want all of your guys' thoughts that way as well, is give me your whole rundown, start to finish, this book, five categories. I'm the host though, so I better go last. Paul, I'm going to make you go first, I think.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. Overall, I absolutely loved this book. Going down our list, we have plot, characters, world building, theme, and point of view. Going straight down the list, plot, I gave it a 9 out of 10. Really? This is hard for me a little bit. I think there's nothing wrong with the plot, but I feel like this is a cop-out, but it always could be better, I guess. And I don't think it had the high moments that our other books have. So I given it a 9. Characters, I don't like doing this at all, but I gave it a 9.5. And that is, once again, I love the characters that we follow in this book. Dusk and Starling, I think, are both outstanding characters and fleshed out really well and things like that. But the books that I've given a 10 to are like somehow even better. And I think this is distinctly not that good, not like the Stormlight level characters good, but really good, especially considering the, you know, it being one book. So I gave it a 9.5, which I don't know if that's cheating or not.
Can I interject here? You said you
world building. I'm kidding.
You really dislike giving it a 0.5. Nobody's twisting your arm to give it a 0.5. You don't have to give it a
0.5. No.
In fact, you're the only one on this podcast that gives 0.5s.
I don't think that's true.
I think that is true.
In this episode, looking at the list, that is true. But I think historically, I think I'm not the only one to give a 0.5. I think it was important here because I think it is specifically better than a 9, but it is specifically not a 10. So I felt like I had to give a 9.5.
I understand.
Felt like a 9 did not do it justice. Okay, world building. I set a perfect 10. I think we learned a lot about the Cosmere and we saw a lot of new things, and I thought it was really cool. It is kind of funny because so much of it is in this like black void Emberdark. So it's like, how well am I going to see what's around me? But like, it did a great job of setting the tone for wherever we are. I think that's one thing that stood out to me originally when we read Six of the Dusk as well, like how vibrant and cool Patchy was. And then here we have that, but also this like Patchy, and then the juxtaposition of that with this like modern society that Dusk finds himself in, and then Emberdark. I think it was really well done, and I think that's what drew me to this book the most as we started to get into it, was that juxtaposition of settings. So I think the world building is a 10. Theme was really good. Wasn't like the best I've ever read, so I gave it an 8. But I don't have anything super negative to say. There were good themes, but not like life-changing, I guess. It was like, you know, be there for your friends type of thing, which I love. But yeah. And lastly, point of view, 9 out of 10. This is probably the hardest one for me to rate on the list. Nothing felt jarring for me. We didn't have like Hoid talking in my ear the whole time or something like that, you know? But yeah, this was a bit interesting. I think if you count the fancy physical version of the book, you might could say this is a 10 out of 10 if you count the cool things they do as like part of the point of view of this book. Because that is really, really cool. But as far as what's written, felt good. No complaints, but maybe not the most outstanding ever. So all in all, that gets me at a 45.5 out of 50, which is a really high review. I really enjoyed this book.
So next up, I think I'm going to make you talk, Trevor. I'll admit, when I pulled up your scores in our outline, I thought I was going cross-eyed for a second, but go ahead and talk us through it.
Why Elliot said that will become very clear momentarily. I gave plot a 9. I gave characters a 9. I gave world building a 9. I gave theme a 9. And I gave point of view a 9.
Why did you do that, Trevor?
Thank you for asking, Paul. So plot. I really enjoyed the plot. It just wasn't Stormlight, so it's not a 10. That's about all I got to say about that. Characters, I gave a 9. They're all great. Starling's a little bit obnoxious, but other than that, they're all great. World building. Okay, so this one I actually considered deviating from my 9s for world building because I loved learning about the Emberdark. I loved sitting down with what's his face? Ed?
Ed the Arcanist?
Yeah, Ed the Wizard. And he just nerded out to me about how Shadesmar works. And I'm like, that's awesome. Thanks. Appreciate that. And I really enjoyed visiting Silverlight. I really enjoyed visiting Yolin. And the Spirit Shores. Can't leave out Spirit Shores. I feel like the weak link was our boat time in the Emberdark. I felt like we were a little slow there in learning about the Emberdark. It was still interesting, but it wasn't perfect, so I gave it a 9. Theme, I gave a 9. And the theme of the book, I really did enjoy. What do you do when life has passed you by and you're still who you originally were, and what do you do with yourself? That's a great question, and I really enjoyed that teasing question. At the end of the book, I was a little dropped on my head, I think, on my theme, that it felt like we didn't really fully flesh out our themes by the end of the book, and I was left a little bit wanting there. And then point of view was great, and I really enjoyed the way we learned information. And yeah, that's all in all a great book, just not a perfect book.
Before I jump into mine, I'll just say I'm really excited to see the two of you guys rate this book so highly, because again, when I set this book down, I was very excited to talk about it with you guys, because I thought as I finished it, I was like, "Ooh, I think Paul and Trevor are really gonna like this." I was a little bit worried, because now I was like, you know, kind of attached to it and enjoying it and hoping you would like it, but like slightly worried that maybe you wouldn't and it wouldn't click for you. So to see this come through, and for this special secret project that I enjoyed a lot out of, and I'm glad to see you guys did too.
Well,
my readings are...
Matt, I'm going to interrupt before you do your ratings. I'm curious what I rated Sunlit Man, because if I had to place this, I would put it below Sunlit Man. Now I'm going to go look and see what I did for Sunlit Man. Go ahead.
For Isles of the Emberdark, for me, I'm going to come in slightly lower than you guys, but still with a very positive vibe. And I thought this was an awesome, really fun adventure. I specifically associate this book, I think, with adventure in my mind. Not that all the other Cosmere books aren't adventures, like they are, but this one just like embodies that. I'm going to set off on a quest and I have no clue where I'm going, and I'm just going to try and figure it out as I go, and hopefully I'll get help along the way. And that's exactly what we did. And that was, it did everything, most everything that it sought out to do quite well. For the categories themselves, plot, I did 9. Paul, I agreed a lot with your thoughts. A lot of really good plot moments. I enjoyed the unraveling of the tale as we kind of figured it out and it came to us, but it didn't quite have as big, huge moments as maybe some other plots in some of our books did. So fully a 9. Characters, I went 8 on this one. This was probably where I thought the book wasn't quite as strong. Still quite good. Brandon is definitely flexing his muscles on the how quickly he can build up a character for you and give you a pretty decent character journey and development in a fairly relatively small amount of chapters and words. But we didn't quite go as deep with some of these characters as I would have liked. I liked a lot of the characters. Dusk is great. Starling is great. For everyone that's not Dusk, I feel like there was much more we could explore. So I just brought it down a little bit there. World building, 9. We learned lots of information. Like you were saying, Trevor, I definitely was drinking it all in, loving every bit of it. I took it down one notch because Brandon's own high standards are so crazy high. And we didn't have like a big magic system that we had to figure out, or there wasn't anything like super clever necessarily that was, you know, a mind blown moment where you're like, oh, wow, that's really cool how he turned that commonplace thing into an entire magic system. It was more just kind of taking bits and pieces of stuff that we had already picked up along the way and piecing it all together in kind of cool ways. Even if you haven't read Six of the Dusk before and the whole bird thing is brand new to you, it's not as novel as some of his other magic systems, I think. So still very strong. It's Brandon Sanderson, but not quite as strong as he has been. So 9. Theme was 8. Really good stuff in here. The old versus new kind of thing. The leadership moments that Starling goes through, her chat with Hoyd. A lot of cool themes baked into those. But Trevor, I think you might have said this, fell a little flat at the end. If the end felt a little bit rushed, we wrapped our plot up decently. Our themes and our characters maybe didn't quite get as solid of a wrap up as I was hoping. 8 out of 10 for theme. Point of view is 9. On principle, I can't give Brandon a 10 for reasons I feel like I talk about on every single book, but this one probably came the closest of any book. I liked the way that we were on that adventure with Dusk. We had no idea what was going to happen as he is setting off into the darkness to do something. And I liked that point of view that we sat in. If Brandon would just describe the word a little more to me, he would get a 10 in this category. But this one was one of his best, I think, in the descriptive qualities in the experience of the reader. Was really fun. All that adds up to 43 out of 50.
What'd you give Yumi and the Nightmare Painter for point of view?
I do actually have that in front of me. So I was going back and tallying all this up. Yumi and the Nightmare Painter got a 7 out of 10 on POV.
What? Wasn't that like the one that you were like super excited that we actually got visuals in that book and described? Oh, there were some good
ones. You're thinking of, that's how he looks at the world building, right? Or am I making that up?
No. So he always complains about point of view because he doesn't get the world described to him enough, like the picture, like Tolkien does. Like for Tolkien, you walk into a scene and then he spends a page describing the scene and then you start talking. Sanderson's like, you start talking and then 3 pages later, oh yeah, we picked up the cup that was there the whole time. Yumi sat in the pictures.
Oh yeah. Yumi has the best descriptions in all of Brandon's writing, unquestionably. And I don't even remember why I docked it. I must have gotten like, maybe I talked about like whiplash between the POVs and, you know, Hoyd kind of yapping at you while you're also trying to jump back and forth between Yumi and Painter. I need to go refresh on why I scored that.
You were probably a Hoyd hater.
I might have been.
I wonder if that's also a little skewed because that was the first secret project we read, right?
Right.
And was it right after Stormlight? Or was it Mistborn first? Mistborn Era 1, maybe?
We had not read Mistborn yet. So it must have been after Rhythm of War.
I think this was Rhythm of War into Yumi. I wonder if that would change a little bit now. I was going to say, I don't know what my old ratings were for the others, but I think this was either my favorite or tied for my favorite secret project.
With Yumi?
Yes. If it's tied, then it's with Yumi. I think Yumi had higher highs, but I think I think more consistently Isles of the Ember Dark was like better, more enjoyable, like throughout the whole of it. Yumi was like up and down for me, depending on the chapters even, but had really, really excellent moments. And things like that. I also think it's funny. I'm probably going to get roasted for this by y'all or by the comments. But for me, I think what separates Yumi and this book from the other why the other secret projects are lower for me is the secondary characters. Like, I think Yumi and this book, I like all the secondary characters are super distinct and like notable for me and like impactful. And I don't think they were near as much for Tress or Sunlit Man didn't really have many. It was basically just Sigzel and Ox, but.
And Rebecca. Don't forget Rebecca.
Don't even remember who that is.
Rebecca Elegy, I think her name
Elegy.
Is.
Elegy, yeah.
Part of my point, I'm like, I don't even remember who these people are.
And the Ember King or Cinder King? Cinder King.
Cinder King. I did remember the Cinder King at least, but that's it.
Okay, so I went back and looked it up. I know somebody's curious. I rated Sunlit Man 46 out of 50. And I just rated this 45 out of 50. And unlike Elliot, I don't fudge my numbers and I don't look back and see what I rated other things. So I'm actually quite happy with that. Rating Isles of Emberdark just one below Sunlit Man. Because I would put Sunlit Man above Isles of Emberdark, but only slightly. I really did enjoy Isles of Emberdark. And comparing it one less to Sunlit Man is quite high praise for me. So.
And on that note, let's just go straight into it. We've been hitting on it already, I think. General thoughts, you know, what is your takeaway on this book?
I think the secret projects, now that we have five of them, is Fires of December going to be a sixth? Is that technically a secret project? I don't even know.
I think so. That's my understanding, but I could be wrong.
I would say that the secret projects are the highest grade Sanderson purity gold. For word count to pay off, secret projects are absolutely where Sanderson shines. And I think he should do more of them. The secret projects, one of the great things about secret projects is your expectations are like zero because you didn't even know it was a thing. So if you hear that he's writing Mistborn Era 3, or if you hear that Elantris 2 is on the table, then you're like, oh, what could he do with that? That's so exciting. And then if you go to the convention and he says, surprise, I have a book coming out next year and it's this, you're like, oh, I have no idea what that is. Excited to find out. That is a good thing for Brandon, I think, that Isles of the Emberdark shines where nobody was expecting it to because nobody knew it existed. I think that's a good thing, and he should keep doing that as opposed to like having this full-on planned cause. I'm not saying like the planned cosmic thing is a bad thing. I'm just saying it might suffer from the weight of its own expectation, whereas secret projects absolutely do not. And they're great.
I'll tack onto that real quick. I think I also can tell in the secret projects that Brandon, I don't know if this is honestly true, but this is what it feels like. It feels like he's just having fun with them.
Could not agree more.
He's just letting loose a bit on the creative side and just kind of going for it. And it really works well when a creator really loves what they're doing. Like, you can tell when you're on the receiving end of that. And I feel like I can tell that he writes these books just because he enjoys doing it. Not to say that he doesn't enjoy writing his other stuff. I think he definitely does. But I think there's a little bit of he's very creative in his other work as well, no doubt about that. But he's also writing to fit a stencil a little bit. His own stencil, his own format, his own outline that he's made. But he's tied himself down just ever so slightly with like a Mistborn or a Stormlight. Whereas, like you were saying, Trevor, Isles of the Emberdark, what the heck is that? What is that going to be about? He can do anything he wants there. And that shines through in a very good way, I think.
I think that was really well said, Elliot. I was going to say, this is one of my favorites, but... And also, Trevor, you absolutely nailed it. Hit the nail on the head with the secret projects and what that like does for Brandon and for like us, like it's really nice to just receive a full, completed, good story that you weren't expecting, you didn't have any emotional investment in. You can read it and you can love it and recommend it and read it again, or you can not like it so much and it's not like something you've been keeping up with this whole time is ruined or something like that. He gets to cover a very wide range of idea. It's been talked about of like how many ideas for like magic systems and stuff he has in his head. And it's like, this is a great way for him to get a lot of those on the page in a really good way. And then it can also just go to people's personal tastes. Y'all love Sunlit Man. I liked it, but I liked it a lot less than y'all did. And I think vice versa with other books, you know, and that's kind of some of the beauty of the secret projects, you know. This book, I think, is an excellent entry. I liked that. I feel like we took a bit of a step back. And like Elliot earlier, you said, it's like we're going on an adventure, kind of just leaving on this adventure, no plan, like no, like main thing, just me and my skills as a trapper, and I'm gonna go figure this out as we go along. And I thought that was more simple and nice, and I thought it was really pleasant, kind of like a step back in fantasy terms. The Cosmere has gotten so big that I feel like this was nice to kind of stay zoomed into this story and the happenings here. So I absolutely loved it. I thought it was great. Like you said, it did not have the same amount of like high highs and things like that. I think like the Sanderlanch in this book really wasn't that spectacular. It was good. Like, I'm not going to say it was bad, but in the scale of Sanderlanches, that wasn't like the Hero of Ages or like these other big finales that are just like super like altering to everything. It wasn't that, and that's not what I was reading it for, you know. It was just really good and crisp throughout, I guess. And I think that I also think it's unique enough that it can kind of stand out on its own a little bit. So, yeah, overall, pretty high review for me. I think it was a good change of pace from the Cosmere that we've been getting into lately.
I completely agree. And that caught me off guard. Maybe we should have seen this coming, knowing that it was an evolution of Sixth of the Dusk. But I fully thought we were going to go grand scale Cosmere. There were a few people that dropped hints or warnings or whatever. They were like, oh yeah, Isles of the Emberdark, it incorporates a lot of things. Was kind of something a couple of people said to me going into it. And I think I misunderstood that, because they're right. There's a lot of elements baked into here and you can pick up on a lot of things, but it's not grand in scale. It's very small in scale, actually. It's really just in the heads of two characters going on one single adventure in one single place.
You both clarified something in my brain just now, and I think I want to make this claim. Sanderson is at its best when he isolates it to just the hero versus the problem. I think strip all of his great world building away, strip everything else back, and pull it back down to the small scale of the hero versus the problem. And the way I think about that is Isles of Emberdark, Elantris, Sunlit Man, that these are all great examples of Sanderson doing one hero versus one problem really, really, really well. And like those three books are probably my top three books outside of Stormlight. I don't know if that's true, but I'm gonna The Lost Middle is probably higher than that. We'll leave Mistborn Era 2 aside for a second. Just simply having Sanderson build a character, put them in a problem and then having that character get out of the problem, like the beginning of the Way of Kings. If you just take the Way of Kings by itself and having Kaladin get out of the bridge cruise, that's some of the best writing Sanderson's ever done. And I think this is like three quarters of a thought. Help me out here that I feel like the best Sanderson writing is simply just the hero versus the problem. And that's what he's maybe best at.
Yeah. I think we had this fear going into future Cosmere books that things are going to become way too complicated with characters, with magic systems and things like that. And I feel like this zoomed in. Elliot said that as well. Like it, there's some big scale things happening, but we're essentially zoomed into Dusk in his boat. And then later this other crew with Starling and things like that. There weren't like a million different players in this book or things like that. It remained fairly simplistic in premise. And so I think that got to let the character shine. I think that got to let the like setting shine and things like that. I think making it less complex gave it more richness, I think.
I think that's Brandon's character writing that is shining in those moments. I think he's probably most known for his world building, and rightly so. But I think that's a close second as far as superpowers for Brandon is he's an extremely character forward writer, and that you are going to be in the shoes of these characters, feeling the emotions they're feeling, dealing with the struggles they're dealing with, having to make the tough choices that they're making. And you feel very much a part of that all the way through. And so when some of his books start to get grand in scale, that starts to tie in really well with his world building, but might start to overshadow a little bit of his character writing. So maybe what you're getting at, Trevor, is books like this, where the character writing really comes to the forefront and we're focusing less on what are the properties of this planet and the investiture around it, and more on what is this character going to do next? It just brings out an aspect of Brandon's writing that maybe we don't focus on as much in other books, and it shines really well.
I will say the other way, a point in the other direction for just isolating the character versus the problem. It limits it to very one-dimensional. And if you don't have the backdrop of all of that world building in Stormlight or Mistborn or whatever, then you don't get those huge character moments that I stay up at night thinking about. Like there's nothing that Dusk did that I'm going to be like a year from now, like, wow, Dusk is such a cool character. There are things that Kaladin and Dalinar and Auxiliary and Wayne have done where I'm like just thinking about the Cosmere during my day, and I think, wow, this character is really cool, because that something that they did stays with me. And because of all of the surrounding world building and setting that has been built and what that action means for that character, you just can't get in Isles of Emberdark. So that you need both, I think, in the Cosmere, and we have both. So it's nice to get Isles of Emberdark, but I'm not saying everything should be Isles of Emberdark.
It's a different flavor. And in the journey that we've been on, I think it's a refreshing different flavor.
Right.
I think we're going to be excited to go back to those giant 5,000-page epic stories. But to take a little detour for a 400-page story that's going to bring different skills of Brandon to the forefront, I think is a great use of our time. Hold that thought a little bit, because we're actually going to tie a question into that here in just a second about if we do zoom out where we left in the Cosmere. But before we do that, we've got our typical spot in the agenda for our wrap-ups for quotes. I've got a few quotes.
Elliot's the only one that prepared quotes because he's the only one that actually read the book.
I did write down a few quotes. Did you guys want to talk about any of them, or do you just want me to hit them lightning style?
Go through them, and then I'll stop you if I want to harp on them.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm probably going to comment after the fact, but I think okay. We should read them first.
Let's do that. So I grabbed a few quotes. There actually were a number of quotable things out of this book that I thought were pretty cool. Maybe not quite as deep or philosophical as some others, but there's a few that tie into the theme of kind of the old versus new. We brought this up a lot. It's a very central theme to this book. And there were a couple of quotes that centered in on it that I thought were pretty good. The first one hits pretty early in the book with Mother Frond. She says to Dusk, "Sometimes we need a person who looks in from yesterday," which I think is pretty clever wording, but also very appropriate to the book when you think back on it.
Let me say this real quick. If Mother Frond turns out to be somebody important in a future book, this quote will have way more weight to it.
It might.
For me. Like, I was expecting this to be really impactful, this book. And it was just like, yeah, okay, this elderly storyteller lady just had a nice quote to tell Dusk as he moved off into his quest.
Well, and Trevor, I'll tell you, there are definitely people out there that I've heard from that are convinced this is cultivation. So
I'm glad to hear
it's
that.
It's very possible.
I'm glad to hear that.
There are definitely people out there who think that is confirmed beyond a doubt. My next quote, similar vein, this time Vothi talking to Dusk, and she says, I like this one a lot, actually. "We are a new person each day. Times change, and we must change with it." Like, that one makes you stop and think for a little bit and captures this whole, we can't just cling to the past. We have to acknowledge that time is a one-way street. It moves forward and only forward, and you can't stop it. And if you just cling on to something relentlessly, it might turn out to be a bad thing. So this idea of kind of reinventing yourself, and then she goes on in the rest of the paragraph, actually, I think, to talk about how, like, empowering that is. Of you kind of get a clean sheet each day. The world is changing, and so are you. So figure out how to reinvent yourself. I don't know. I like that one.
I know I said I was going to wait till the end of all of them to comment, but I think this is my favorite of these because, it's something that I feel like I can take with me as I go. We followed Dusk's story where he feels out of place, you know, like his role is essentially like obsolete and he feels like the world has passed him by. And, you know, I feel like that's something that anyone might fear for whatever reason. And so this is something that I'm trying to take with me as I go throughout life, you know, as I get further from school and all these like things, you know, like, adapting and all the things like that. Trying to not be stubborn in my old ways, you know.
I will say, Elliot, in Wind and Truth, you said multiple times that there was a lack of throw pillow quotes in Wind and Truth.
Yes.
And there was there needed to be a lot more build up for the Wind and Truth quotes to have good payoff. Those two are absolutely throw pillow quotes.
They are. Yeah, they have, like we were just talking about, less weight behind them, perhaps, because they don't have, you know, 1,000 pages of character journey behind them. But they're very quippy. Definitely put that on a throw pillow. Third out of four. This one comes from Chrysalis towards the end of the book. And I thought this was a good foreshadowing of what's to come, maybe, in the Cosmere. This is our bit of nugget, our bit of wink, wink, nod, nod of this is what's coming. And Chrysalis is talking with Dusk and says, "Technology has not killed the gods, but it has made them smaller." And again, kind of catchy way to say that technology is advancing, and technology is advancing fast in the Cosmere as a whole. And then my last one speaks, I think, less to maybe the state of the Cosmere and more to the state of Brandon, that this felt like the most Brandon Sanderson quote ever. And it's not as well like fleshed out into a quote. I'm even like already kind of stealing parts of a paragraph and parts of another, but this concept is so Brandon and I love it. It's just the narrator talking. It's not even a character, but the narration text of the book says, gods could not be contained by steel, ceramic, or even an invested shield. But a story, well, that was another thing entirely. And the context of that was all as they were talking about, I think that the Daquara giant invested entity, there's no tool you have that can beat it. But if you just believe that it is something that's constrained in a certain figure, it will be so. And the power of myth is greater than any technology that you have. That just, Hoyt didn't say it, but Hoyt certainly could have said it. Feels like a Hoytism.
Yeah. Or was Hoyt the narrator? No. Good quotes, Elliot. Good quotes.
And that kind of brings us to just a couple of like discussion questions coming out of this. Now that we've read Isles of the Everdark.
Well, hold on.
Go ahead.
Finish your sentence. Finish your sentence.
What I was going to lead into is I want to talk with you guys a little bit about where are we at now at the end of this book? Where are we headed next? What have we gleaned from this book, which you think might be important going forward in the Cosmere as we go to read Mistborn Era 3, Stormlight Era 2? What do you think might have just been handed to us that's going to be relevant and important?
Okay, pause on that. We'll get back to that. I want to cover our first episode predictions first, and then we'll talk about the book.
Go ahead.
So I have to harp on this because Paul won the giveaway contest and it was not close. Our first episode predictions, Elliot threw a bunch of questions at us and we will answer them here. The first question was, how many planets will we visit? Paul said 3 and I said 4. And I think the answer to this is 2. 3? I don't actually know the answer to this.
I think if we want to get technical, and I phrased the question a little bit intentionally, like I didn't want to give anything away, so I said, how many planets will we visit?
Right.
Planets, we saw 2. Yolen and Dromedan.
Right.
But like places in the Cosmere, we saw several others. We saw Silverlight, which was awesome. We saw the Spirit Shores, which I think is like a spiritual realm thing.
Yeah.
But we saw this other island that's presumably another planet that
kind of
we just never went to, but we were on the other side of, we were on the upside down or whatever.
We definitely didn't visit it.
Right. So I think the answer is technically 2, if you want to go letter of the law here.
I think it is as well. I think it's actually 2, but there's some fun other places we kind of mentioned.
So if this is a competition, Paul has a point. Next question. How many familiar characters will we see or hear mentioned? Elliot asked us this. I said a bazillion. Paul said 5. I actually said 12. And this question,
close to a bazillion. Yeah.
Yes. This question is not actually that easy to answer. It really depends on what you count as hear or mention. Because if you're counting shards, and if you're counting like references to characters without the character being mentioned, this gets really high really quick. So there's 3 different ways to tally this as far as I could tell. Paul said 5, I said 12. Who are definitely mentioned character, not a shard, without a shadow of a doubt, is Frost, Naz, Crow, Hoyd, Zysis, Huyo, Chris, Noadon, Sigzil, and Design. For a total of 10. That's like the absolutely was answered by the question 10. I'll come back to the next 2. If you're counting shards, then there's Eidolon, Invention, Virtuosity, Dominion, Odium, and Ambition. So that adds another 6 already. So we're at 16. Hey, 16. If you're including shards, that's funny. Okay, so if you're including those, then we're well past our predictions already. But also, according to the Coppermind, I didn't actually remember this in the book, but maybe you guys can help me. Sazed is referred to, and the wind on Roshar is also referred to. Is that a character? I don't know. So how do you guys want to tally this? Do we want to count shards? Do we want to count Sazed being referred to not by name?
Well, I mean, I know I was wrong, so I don't think we have to go sure. on it too much. But I thought, if I remember correctly, which I don't, obviously, I thought this was more so like characters we will meet, which I will say we did meet way more friendly faces than I met memorable names than I thought we would. I did not think we'd be meeting, or, you know, Naz and Zysis and Huyo. I definitely did not see the Huyo mention coming. That was kind of crazy. Master, wise sage, arcanist Huyo or whatever. And I definitely did not see Noadon coming. So that's pretty right. crazy. Right. I just didn't remember if it was like named or met. I guess I was thinking in my prediction like met.
If you only count met, you're a lot closer, because then you wouldn't include Chris or Huyo or Noadon or Sigzel. Like, those
or design, yeah.
Those characters were mentioned by name, but we did not meet them by any means.
Yeah, you would have the Frost, Naz, Crow, Hoid, Zysis, which is 5.
And design is there.
Design is there.
Oh, design is there. Okay, yes.
And but if we go back into the shards thing, arguably true. Ambition. I would put ambition in there.
Okay.
That we did meet and talk to Ambition.
As the entity?
No, as the voice.
You think that's... Ooh, okay, so this is going to tie into a question I'm going to ask you. You think that's not autonomy?
I'm sorry, that's what I meant, autonomy.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I meant. You're right, the entity is a splinter of Ambition. Yeah, I keep getting those two mixed up. So, anyway. Yeah, depending on how you... count it. I'm still going to count the point for myself, so we're at 1-1. How will Hoid appear, or will he at all? Paul said he's going to appear as a bug.
I said he's going to appear, but a bonus fish. Bonus point if he's a bug or a fish. I think that's what I was saying.
And I said he would appear in a late cameo, and the answer was absolutely a late cameo, so I get a point there. Haha. And the final question was, how many characters will die? And Paul said 0, and I said 1.9, and then Paul said 0.1, so that he could get the one character death, and then I gave it up, and I said 2. So the answer, I think, is pretty unarguably 1.
Why?
One character, Dager.
Okay.
Dager is a main character with dialogue, and he died.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Did anybody else die? So I think Paul gets that point.
No heroes died, which is definitely what I was getting at.
Sure.
By the way, like, we're not going to have, you know, Dusk and Starling aren't going to die, you know. Everyone's too plot protected.
Chrysalis almost died.
That's close. True. People always almost die.
Yes.
That's how it goes.
For some reason, I thought this would be Brandon's deviation book and everybody would die, but no, that did not happen.
Yeah.
Okay.
People I just want to only cover die those. In the main series books, Trevor. And eventually. Then they rarely do.
I was going to say, after like 1,000 pages, they die.
Yeah, they die at the last couple chapters of the big series, and then that's it.
Okay. I wanted to cover those. Now we can get into our deeper discussion questions. Go ahead, Elliot.
Yes. Back to the, okay, what do we need to remember? Well, that's not quite the question I want to ask. Zoom out. Like we just talked about, this book was zoomed in. We did get a trip to Silverlight. We did get some very interesting Cosmere mechanics talk to us about the Emberdark, Shadesmar, whatever you want to call it. We learned a lot about dragons and their politics. But like, moving on into other books, Stormlight Era 2, Mistborn Era 3, what are you guys kind of now on the lookout for? What do you take away from this book from a large-scale Cosmere geopolitics perspective?
I think I learned a lot more about dragons. You know, obviously we knew they weren't like the classic dragon sits on their hoard of gold, but we got way more. I did not envision them as kind of like almost like savvy businessmen across the Cosmere, and things along that line. That wasn't a picture I had, but really the chapter we had talking with Zysus a lot really kind of nailed that home to me, that the scale of how they think through time, the like, there are many things that they, you know, do that was very different than I even knew. So I think that, and their role essentially, what they do kind of in geopolitics across the Cosmere. So I think that was the biggest thing I learned, or at least my favorite thing.
Which for me definitely changed my thinking after coming out of Tress. Because when we saw Zysus in Tress, he very much fit the mold of cranky, powerful being who just sits on his hoard of gold and you don't want to cross paths with him unless you have to. And then we get here and Zysus is there. And all of a sudden, like you said, now he's a savvy businessman who trades in information. He seems very controlled, long-term thinking, not just the cranky guy who's going to roast you for stealing a cup out of his hoard, but more of a mastermind behind the scenes kind of thing. So I do think we learned a lot about dragons.
The thing that stuck out the most to me is what we learned in the first like four chapters, and it's Scadrial versus Roshar. And I cannot get out of my head, is Scadrial versus Roshar going to be in our main series, or is that just like something that happens after our main series are done? Like, is Mistborn Era 3 going to be about Mistborn, or is it going to be about Scadrial versus Roshar? I don't know. Is Stormlight Era 2 going to have Skadrians attacking us from space? I don't know.
Which again brings up the whole timeline thing, which I think we've gone back and forth on. And I don't know that I like have an answer on this, is when is this book set? Isles of the Emberdark.
Yeah, we do need to have a discussion about the timeline thing. Because so everybody, as far as I can tell, the vast consensus is this is way in the future past anything we've ever read, and it doesn't have anything to do with our current day Stormlight politics or our current day Mistborn politics. All that has changed in the future, and this is completely removed from any of that. I'm not convinced of that, and the reason why I say that is because of how our Skybreaker acts. I'll set the scene in case you don't remember. We just chase off the ones above from, this is like chapter 6 of Isles of Everdark. The ones above leave, and then the Rosharan that they were keeping in the back room like comes in and says, and it's like a big bully, and it's like, hey, you should side with us because we're nicer than the Skadrians. But it is, he doesn't even say that. He's like, we won't conquer you. We'll ally with you, and the Skadrians will conquer you, so you should ally with us. And then one of the politicians gets up in his face, and then the Skybreaker's trying to, like, shoot him or something. And call it wishful thinking. I'd like to think that there's some redemption for our Skybreakers in the future. And if this is way, way in the future, and the Skybreakers, or at least a sect of them, are still just completely warped and twisted and have no real sense of what actual justice is, then I'm just so hung up on that fact. How can the Skybreaker still be so twisted and manipulated if our current day Stormlight politics are not still a thing? That's the jump I come to of Roshar must still be a pretty messed up place if the Skybreaker showing up is acting like this and is a representative for like the planet. So with all that said, I feel like this is more relevant than people are giving it credit for earlier days or earlier day geopolitics in the Cosmere.
I think I could see this maybe being a hint that when we start to see Rosharans next to in the context of people from other planets, they might come off as brash, direct, blunt kind of thing. You know, that's a Kaladin is fairly that way. But I'm wondering if that's going to be a thing going forward of like, that might be almost like a joke in the Cosmere of the Rosharans are not the like devious, sneaky, clever ones. They're the lay it out in front of you and threaten you if they have to and try to get you to do what they want. And that's maybe the vibe we're going for here, but I'm kind of with you of that guy did not give me good feels. And that raises a lot of questions for
right.
When and what is going on Roshar.
Thank goodness for the Sunlit Man, or else I would have a lot of despairing thoughts about Skybreakers. But because Sunlit Man exists, the Skybreakers are awesome.
You can fly your Skybreaker flag proudly because of
Sunlit Correct. Man. Correct.
Yeah, I'm confused. I thought this was going to like answer some questions for us about the geopolitics of the Cosmere. And I don't feel like I got any answers. I got questions of what are the agendas of these people? We know that the Skadrians, or more specifically the Malwish, are trying to make power plays across the Cosmere because we see them in Sunlit Man. We see them here again, where they are trying to follow the rules. They're trying to not upset the balance. They're trying to fly under the radar as much as they can so the shards don't band together against them. But they are trying to grab up as much real estate as they possibly can.
Something that I did also notice is it is specifically the Malwish. And the term Malwish and Skadrian are not a complete one-to-one interchangeable in this story as seen by Starling. So Starling says, like, I think it's a mental dialogue of she didn't get along with most Skadrians and certainly not the Malwish. Which makes me think Skadriel and Roshar might be under the same format of there might be a ruling empire of the Malwish or I guess he's Retribution, and then there might be a hostage, smaller empire that are the good guys, right? Like the Basin might be under siege, or a fragile treaty with the Malwish. Don't come step on us, and it might just be the Malwish, the bad guys, versus Taravangian, the bad guys. And everyone else is just trying to stay out of their way. I think that's a very interesting idea.
I do think the very obvious takeaway we're supposed to walk away with this book from is the Elykin navigators. That feels like the most relevant piece of this coming out of this at all is we've gone spacefaring now, or ember dark faring with all of our civilizations. We just got released to us the fact that it is still very hard to navigate in the Ember Dark unless you have an Elykin navigator. That's going to be important.
I agree. We barely touch on this at the end of the book, but this is kind of a big deal going forward of what are these navigators going to do. You know, I'm very curious to see. I fully expect we will see more navigators in the future.
I had one last question I wanted to ask you guys. And it came up briefly as we were reading the chapters. And I asked you some leading questions about it. We talked about it a little bit. But it's not really answered. So I wanted to come back to it. Dusk hears a voice. And as I was reading it through the book a second time here, I was specifically looking for this. Is it Dusk imagining this, or is it a literal clear, he hears a voice in his head and he thinks it's Patchy? He's very convinced this is the voice of Patchy. We hit some theories fairly early, which I think are well supported, that autonomy is involved. Autonomy is in the mix here. We think this perpendicularity is a leftover from an avatar of autonomy who probably was Patchy. I'm not 100% convinced that the voice Dusk is hearing is autonomy. What do you guys think?
I think it is that simple. I think autonomy was training. It's pretty classic autonomy, right? If you're survival of the fittest, right? You throw a bunch of trappers on the planet, whoever's the fittest gets the privilege of being my gifted son or whatever. And Dusk graduated. That's the whole point.
So does that make all of these trappers avatars of autonomy?
No, they're like invested. I don't know how to say this. No.
Acolytes of autonomy.
There you go. That's better. They're not all Telson. They're more like members of the set.
Okay.
If you remember your Mistborn Era 2 terms correctly.
I think so.
Because, so, when autonomy shows up in Mistborn Era 2, the set are all trying to compete with each other to be able to be the avatar of autonomy.
Right.
And Telson gets it at the end.
Yep.
And then autonomy kills Telson. That's what's happening here. Autonomy is putting a bunch of trappers on the same set of islands, allowing them to kill each other, and saying whoever, like, survival of the fittest. And then the Skadrians show up with a bunch of technology and ruins his plans. And then he has to, like, you know, actually step in and hang out with Dusk.
Interesting. Okay. I hadn't put all those pieces together of the, like, autonomy's plans are ruined or deviated. It feels to me, maybe I'm comparing it to Mistborn Era 2 too hard. It felt like autonomy was very directly involved with Telson. There was that weird army of autonomy where the whole point there was Telson is opening up a portal so that autonomy can directly invade the planet.
Right.
Here, it feels like I don't understand what autonomy is trying to do here. It almost feels like autonomy is very distant, and this is almost just like an echo of autonomy's presence. It's not even like autonomy's really paying attention to Dusk. It's just Dusk has stumbled across leftover autonominess, and
no,
I don't know.
I totally understand what you're saying, and I think I would agree with you that autonomy has all sorts of tendrils and plants and seeds all across the cosmere. Some of them sow, or some of them reap, and some of them don't. And this is just the leftovers of Patchy is the leftovers of autonomy's plans for Dromedad. And maybe autonomy has moved on thousands of years ago, but Patchy's the leftover red, like there's still a bunch of investiture, self-aware investiture that is autonomy.
Yeah.
And this is just the side effect of it.
Okay. I think I track with that. I can track with that. I'm gonna spin a challenging question off of that, but Paul, do you have anything to add before I do that?
No, I'm curious to hear the question.
Okay. So given all that, if this is autonomy, Dusk appears to have, yeah, won the competition, be the front runner, the one with the most attention of autonomy on it, you know, being given powers by autonomy. Autonomy is not a good guy.
Correct.
Right? Like, whereas Dusk very much is. You finish this book, like, Dusk is the hero. Dusk saved the day. Dusk saved his people. Dusk did the right thing. But has a link directly to a shard that is probably in the villain category. Do we see a problem with this? Is that going to come up again later where that's going to be bad? Question?
I would love to read that story. Dusk figures out he's on the wrong team and has to figure out how to get off of it.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting story. Yeah, I could totally see the story that Trevor just mentioned. Or figuring out how to utilize it or something. I'm not sure.
Ooh.
Trevor just had an idea.
I did. So let's make the assumption that I think is pretty safe to make, that Dusk has capital C connection to Patchy autonomy, the autonomy sliver on Dromanad. What happens when he goes sailing with Starling and meets another sliver of autonomy? Like, what if he went and met Telson? Would they... Now I'm confusing myself. Like, how does autonomy interact with autonomy? They probably fight each other.
Right. It probably is a power struggle.
Yeah.
That's kind of autonomy's point, right? Is I'm going to pit the two of you against each other, and whoever's the most powerful is going to be the one that gets my power. So I almost envision, like I liked your description earlier of like tendrils. Autonomy is going out and planting these seeds, these feelers out throughout the whole Cosmere. But as those bits of autonomy, you know, bump into each other, it's kind of like a survival of the fittest kind of thing. They're going to fight each other. One's going to consume the other and then become a more powerful chunk of autonomy out there in the Cosmere. So I think your question is really relevant. Dusk is out there traveling. He's invested with some level of connection to autonomy. If he goes and spends some time on a planet that has another avatar of autonomy, that could be a big problem. That could be a way he discovers, whoa, hold on a second. That's not who I thought I was in service to with this whole Patchy thing.
This is where I wish I'd read White Sand, because autonomy is autonomy is from Tal'Dane, and Tal'Dane, White Sand. Yeah, we need to know about White Sand.
I did not know that. I did not know that autonomy was from Tal'Dane. So that does raise some questions for me. Very trial based. That's all I know about White Sand. Somewhat is it's like trial based. You know,
right?
Like I feel like who has done better at passing trials than Dusk here.
There's sand surfing or whatever they have in that first chapter that we read. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's Brandon's version of Dune is all I know. You've got magic sand and people fighting over the magic sand.
Correct.
I think I might have said last question, but actually there's one more.
Are we ready for the $1 million question?
There is a $1 million question that I think we need to address, because I've seen some fairly heated discussion on the interwebs about this question.
The internet getting heated over nothing?
There's some strong opinions.
No way.
There are some strong opinions out there about this one. I'm actually fascinated by it. I might be about to throw my opinion out there and stoke the fires a little bit. The question is, reading order. We've read pretty much the whole Cosmere, except for White Sands, like we were just talking about. Now that you've read Isles of Emberdark, what are your requirements for reading this as you are recommending to either a brand new Cosmere reader or maybe like a baby Cosmere reader? And they're like, oh, I've read a few things. I saw the cover of Isles of Emberdark looks really cool. Can I read that one? Where do you sit on this spectrum? Because there are people all over it, I think.
I'll go first. Actually, no, Paul goes first, because Paul's answer to this is much more simpler than mine.
My answer to this is pretty simple. I think people can read this right away. This may be a hot take, but I think the obstacles you have when reading this right away are, okay, our crew members have various things with them that you don't know why that's important or where they're from. But I think you can get past that. In fact, I feel like this might draw someone further into the Cosmere in kind of a fun way. You meet this eclectic crew and you don't know for sure. But frankly, other than Chrysalis, I feel like their powers aren't that pivotal to the story. They're like unique powers or wherever they come from. You know, you are going to hear a lot of names and mentions that you don't know. But when you start The Way of Kings, you get a bunch of names and mentions of things that you don't know. And I think you could start here, which is probably a bit of a hot take. I think you can.
And to back you up a little bit, would you agree, Paul? It doesn't feel like this book is going to spoil anything for you.
I would agree with that. Yeah, I don't think this is going to spoil anything for you. I feel like I had some examples, too, of even other things that might be more rich if you read this beforehand. But I don't think that's the case. I think Zysis would feel different whenever you read Tress after this.
Right.
And Aethers in general will be kind of interesting, but nothing major. You don't learn much of anything about Aethers in this. It's not that big of a deal. So, yeah, I think there's not any kind of major drawback to doing it this way.
Well, my take is similar to yours, Paul. So, Trevor, unless you want to grab it now and run with yours, I feel like I can just add on to what Paul was saying.
No, go ahead.
I think my final answer I get to this is, in theory, anyone can read this book. If you're a brand new Cosmere reader and Isles of Emdark is the cover you see in Barnes & Noble and you think it's cool and you pick it up and you read it, I don't think you've broken anything for your Cosmere read. I think it's going to be fine. That said, I don't think it's a book I'm going to recommend as a starting point. In pretty much any case I can think of, I'm probably recommending something else as a starting point for any of the possible Cosmere readers out there. And for most people who are, if they know what they're getting into with the Cosmere, they know it's big, they know it's all intertwined, and they want to like kind of discover things in an order, I'm probably going to recommend to them that they read all of Mistborn and Tress before this one. I think that's going to be a logical progression for this. I think knowing a bit about the politics on Scadrial is going to give you a little bit of context that's going to help you here with the whole Malwish and Scadrian stuff.
Yeah.
And then the Aethers on Tress. If you've had that explained to you, that will help you understand, I think, a little bit more about what our characters are talking about in their figuring out what do we do here in Isles of the Emberdark. So I think my final answer is there are no requirements to reading this book, but I'm probably going to recommend it further down the line, but not necessarily after Stormlight. I don't think you need to read Stormlight at all for this book. Is it going to help you understand stuff? Absolutely, 100%. But you can definitely read this book before any Stormlight experience. In fact, it'd be very interesting to see someone do that, to see the Rosharan in
here. Hear about Noadon before.
Yeah, to hear about Noadon, to hear about, you know, all these, this, you know, myth of the, what are they called? Heralds, the warriors, and see Chrysalis, to talk with a Sleepless, and then start to like get that kind of drip fed to you slowly through Stormlight later would be fascinating and totally fine way to digest this as a Cosmere book. But Trevor, what are your thoughts?
All right. I've become more convinced of this as I've heard you both of you talk. The question is, can you hand this to somebody first? Can you? The answer to that is yes. Would I? The answer to that is no. Same to what Elliot said. There are plenty of better starting points for the Cosmere. Now, when I would recommend this to someone is the question. And here's how I'll answer that. If the reader is completely sold on the Cosmere, they're on a Brandon Sanderson binge, and they're going to read everything, they should read this last. If they're going to get to it, they should read it last. If they're in danger of putting down the Cosmere, you should give this book to them. I think that this book is a very strong contender for the very high potential of Brandon Sanderson. And like, if they're completely sold, they've read Mistborn Era 1, they've read, you know, Yumi the Nightmare Painter or whatever, and then they're just looking for the next book, don't give them this yet. Let them find this eventually. But if they're like, yeah, I read Warbreaker, it was all right, and I've started Mistborn, but it's not my thing, then you could give this to them. And I think it would help them. What are your thoughts on that?
I do think, I don't think this is last. I think something like, I recognize the timeline makes sense to be last, but I think Sunlit Man might need to be last. I think that's like, I totally see what you mean. Can I hand this book to someone first? I think yes, but should I? No, probably not. I do agree with that. I think that's a good place to be. I do think that this is not necessarily last. I think once you are... I definitely think Sunlit Man should be... I think Sunlit Man has more serious prerequisites. I don't think you have to have any books read to read this. However, I do think you will enjoy this book more and take away more from it if you have read like Mistborn, like Elliot said. I don't think you have to read Stormlight, but I do think, I mean, you can read The Sunlit Man without having read other stuff, but I do think you are massively missing out on what you're supposed to feel.
I would agree with that.
If you haven't read Stormlight. And I think that's a big distinction. So I think this could fit into various slots. I think basically if I were planning somebody's route through the Cosmere, this would probably be somewhere in the middle-ish. I mean, if I was planning it, I would love for people to start with Stormlight. But if I'm like planning like an optimal route, what I think the average person would probably like learn the best from, it probably wouldn't be, it'd probably be later on. But essentially to say, I think there's less prerequisites for this than something like Sunlit. But I do think prerequisites are definitely good for it still.
Here's my problem with the middle though. There are really important details in here. And if you're fully invested in the Cosmere and you're sold on it, you're going to pick up on those details and you haven't read that book yet. And that might be an issue. Right? Like, let's say you've read The Way of Kings and you're like, all right, Stormlight's not for me, but I'm still interested in Brandon Sanderson. You should not give them this book because there's going to be a Skybreaker flying in and like a bad mouthing the Skadrians. And that's going to be really confusing.
I think I do agree with you on that. I think if it's like right after starting and they're unsure, then this probably isn't the one. However, I think if they're at a point where you would reasonably say like you can read any of the secret projects, like let's say they have read a bit, Mistborn Era 1 and I don't know, two books of Stormlight or something like that. I think they could choose to read any of the secret projects and know like they're all various points in the timeline, various places, like the whole sentiment of the secret projects. I think it's like take your pick, like you don't have to go against them. I feel like depending on where they are in the Cosmere, I would, where they are specifically in Stormlight, I would question on the Sunlit Man. But the others, I'm like, there's not a serious stipulation. I don't think as serious as the others. Like, knowing the Malwish is going to be helpful, but I feel like not the end of it, I guess. But yeah, I do think, like, if you're reading the whole of the Cosmere, you're going to do it all. I do agree that this should wait until later. So maybe I'm being convinced that it is indeed later. I think for pure enjoyment, like, if I were to hand someone, like, hypothetically, it doesn't matter the reading order, just hand me your favorite books from the Cosmere in order, this would be on the earlier portion for sure. Like, this is one of my favorites. If not Tide, then it's my favorite secret project. So it would be the first of them that I would want them to read. Sure. If that makes sense. So I probably am a bit biased in, like, I want people to read this one, you know? So,
Trevor, you said something interesting that's intrigued me now. You almost described this as, you could maybe use this as a cure for Cosmere burnout. If someone has read some Cosmere, but kind of hit the point where they're, like, burning out on it a little bit, and they're willing to read another Brandon Sanderson book, but they're either burnt out on Stormlight or intimidated by Stormlight or something like that, handing them this as, okay, here's a quick standalone to get you re-excited about the Cosmere.
Yeah.
I could almost see this fitting that niche a little bit.
I think it fits solidly in the Yumi category, where there are things that you should know, but you don't need to know them.
Yumi is a particularly difficult example there, because there is a whole chapter in Yumi where Hoid sits you down and explains investiture with of big words that I'm very torn on Yumi with this particular question. Because it could be a decent intro to people, or it could be just really confusing.
Right.
I don't think Isles of Emberdark has that risk necessarily. Maybe there's a situation where it leads someone down a confusing road, but I think I like your thought there of, you could definitely save it to last, or if you just need something different and you don't want to buy into a whole series at the moment that you're at, this is a perfectly acceptable one to pick up for a one-off adventure.
So we've firmly established the opinion of baby.
It depends.
Sometimes.
Maybe sometimes. There you go, internet. Roast us for that. Bring all your hot takes and strong opinions and tell us how right or wrong we are about our maybe sometimes answer. About whether you can read Isles of the Emberdark first or last. All right. Any other final thoughts on Isles of the Emberdark, gentlemen?
I don't think so. I really enjoyed this book, and I'm excited for the next couple weeks and what we have in store.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we talked a lot about this book, but yeah, I feel like this is one I could easily see myself rereading. It seems like a good situation if you want to sit down and enjoy a book, you know? So, looking forward to that.
Alrighty. Well, with that, I think I have to hand the control panel of this podcast back over to Trevor. My time in the pilot seat is coming to a close, unless maybe I get elected to lead whatever future books were going down. But Trevor, I officially ceremonially hand the controls back to you.
Feels good. All right. We will reconvene next week. Thanks for joining me, Paul and Elliot.
Toodles.
As always, on we go.